This is The Spark. I'm Martha Whitrow. If you've listened to public radio for any time at all, you probably recognize Alex Chadwick's voice, for he's been a public radio reporter, producer, and show developer for many years. Alex, who lives in Los Angeles, helped create Morning Edition, was chief correspondent for NPR's long-running National Geographic Radio Expeditions series, and has probably hosted every NPR program at one time or another. The last 3 years have not been kind ones. Alex was let go unexpectedly by NPR in 2009 during their draconian cost-cutting measures, and he lost his wife shortly thereafter. Alex Chadwick's in Charlottesville right this minute to be part of the Look 3 Festival of the Photograph. And since he likes to chat outside, he and I sat around on a back porch in downtown Charlottesville chatting about life in public radio. Turns out Alex Chadwick's relationship with Virginia goes way back.
I was a suburban kid in Northern Virginia, in Dunloring. Now, Dunloring is a little town outside Washington, D.C. And when I was a kid, I mean, this was living in the country. My sister had a horse, which was a great, big, dangerous, stupid animal, but she loved it anyway. So we would go to this little hay and feed store, like a mile down the road and then left on another road. And today, that hay and feed store is Tyson's Corner. That's where, yeah. So somehow, anyway, that imprinted me deeply and made me the person that I am today as a kind of former, sometime Virginian, and now journalist, reporter, and yeah.
Before we get to the Virginia-centric sort of stuff, I want to ask you about two things that you've recently been involved in. One is the Interviews 50 Cent project.
Yes.
I read about that and thought, oh, this is luscious.
So this idea came to me after many, many failures at National Public Radio, because a typical kind of thing for a news director to do, or at a place like NPR, would be say, okay, the Supreme Court has said X, go outside in the street and ask them. So you go out and you sort of kind of start surveying people about what do you think about what the court did today. Most people don't know what the court did today. And then even if they do know what the court did today, they kind of know about it, but they don't have a very smart, considered opinion that you actually think, yeah, that's something I want to tell people about. People don't know about that stuff. What they know about is their own lives, and their own lives are full of stories, maybe not full, but there are these kind of stories, these magic moments in their own lives that they can talk about. So it finally occurred to me that the reason that I had such a crummy batting average with these kind of man-in-the-street interviews was I was asking the wrong question. And the right question to ask was, tell me a story. What's your best story? What's going on with you now? But then you need a tableau, you know? You need a kind of like a stage for that to happen on. You need a train to go by. We're sitting in the back porch of the South Street Inn, and there is a train not very far away. There it goes. Okay, all right. Well, listen, ignore the train. Well, so you need a way to get these stories out of people, and I kind of thought, well, I couldn't sort of think of a way that I, and then I remembered Lucy in the Peanuts cartoon where there's psychiatric help, 5 cents, and I just thought, that's it. I'm going to have something like a booth, and I'll put up a sign that says Interviews 50 Cents, and we'll just see what happens. And really what happened was people would come along, and they'd look at the sign, and they'd say, huh. Do I pay you or do you pay me? And I'd say, well, sit down and let's see how it goes.
And so what happened? What did you do with all this stuff?
Well, I sold it to ABC News, and they had a very short-lived magazine show in the 90s called Day One, which was about how long the show lasted. And then so it went off. But the producer who was doing it with me was this wonderful guy named Ray Farkas, who'd worked at NBC. And he was a brilliant television producer. And we fell in love with this idea because you do get people to sit down and tell you really beautiful stories. And they're funny and they're sad and they're just human. They're just these people really want to tell stories. They really want to. And a lot of them are good at it. At least they're good at their stories, you know. So after ABC kind of went away, we sort of tried to sell it to people. We could never do it. But then when the internet sort of sprouted and went out, and then sites started looking for video and companion video, Slate, the magazine Slate.com, which was a first online magazine, they wanted to launch a kind of a video companion to them, Slate V. And they, the people there, had seen the original interviews 50 Cent, and they came to me and said, can you recreate that? Can you do it again? So we started doing it again, and I'm still doing it. So the way that we shoot this, Ray, this great producer who has passed away, I'm sorry to say, about 8 years ago, Ray has done a lot of this kind of work that's sort of like this. So he likes to keep these cameras way back. So the camera would be 20 feet away from us. So when you're sitting down to do an interview with someone, you don't want to intimidate them, you know. So we have no lights, and the cameras are way back, and they have long lenses on them. And it's very common for – we make so little commotion, so little – that people don't even know we're there. So people wander back and forth in front of the cameras, and we love that. It's great. I mean, so it feels like you're really eavesdropping on this conversation. It's just – It feels very informal and very free, and then it's and very genuine, which it is. I did it for years for Slate, and I was only losing a little bit of money on each one. And as long as that was true, I was going to keep doing it, you know, because you kind of you're accumulating this just beautiful trove of stories. And I know they're smart and they're interesting and they're funny. I've been making media all my life. And I know that this is really good, and I just can't stop doing it.
Was that your first video foray?
No, I worked after I'd worked at NPR for several years. I was hired as a writer at a television station in San Francisco, okay. And I went out there and worked in local news for about 2 years until I was ready to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And so I gave up on that.
At this point, I had to take a break and fiddle around unprofessionally with my notes, which did not go unnoticed.
Martha, it's very disappointing that you're not prepared enough for this interview.
I'm
already spectacularly, you know, on for my interviews. I know everything.
Humbled as I was in the presence of greatness, I asked Alex Chadwick about a program he created recently called The Descent, which tells the story of two men whose troubles and tragedies find respite in the raging rapids of Utah's Cataract Canyon.
This was a very important piece of work for me. My wife died 2 years ago, and she had been the love of my life and also my working partner at National Public Radio. She created this relationship we had that NPR had with National Geographic, and she was a great producer and a great love, and just a brilliant, funny, beautiful woman. She had a form of cancer for 10 years. For most of that time, it was fine. It was under control. And the last 6 months were pretty hard. And some things had happened at NPR that were unpleasant for both of us. So the last couple of years were very hard. And kind of coming out of that experience, you're just kind of lost for a while and don't sort of know where things are, what you're doing. I knew that I had to start working again, and I was interested. I was no longer working at NPR, and so I wasn't going to be a program host anymore. If you're a program host, even for NPR, you don't actually have to know that much, because what you're going to do is a series of interviews every day. You're going to do, you know, 3 or 4 or 5. And honestly, you need to be able to, you need to learn how to prepare in 20 minutes to talk about absolutely anything and sound like you know what you're doing. And I could do that. And, I mean, people like Robert Siegel really is smart. Robert actually does know quite a lot. And, there were things that I knew about, but I was not going to be able to do. I had to actually know something pretty well if I was going to be a journalist, I thought, to, you know, go back to being a regular reporter. And I thought, you know, energy and climate, I'm never going to run out of stories, and it'll give me a reason to drive around the American West, which I like to do anyway. So I started following the news, and I learned that Utah is a kind of locus of a lot of kind of energy stories. You've probably heard about the tar sand pit in Canada, and these the tar sands are what's supposed to be coming down the Keystone XL pipeline, and it's a controversial source of energy. So there's a permitting process underway in the United States right now for what would be the first U.S. tar sands facility in Utah. And there's other unconventional, important energy development underway there. So I started following that, and then I met this guy, Tim DeChristopher, who is a climate activist who was arrested in December of 2008 at the end of the Bush administration. He went to a Federal Bureau of Land Management oil and gas lease auction in Salt Lake City. He bid on a bunch of properties that he couldn't pay for in order to prevent them being sold and developed. He just firmly believes that any more carbon development is very bad. So this was an act of civil disobedience on his part, but he didn't really understand the law or what he was doing when he did this. Because, you know, most people who commit an act of civil disobedience, they have to do a sit-in, or and they're misdemeanors, you know, and you're treated as a, you know, you might spend the night in jail. But what Tim did was commit two felonies, and he had been tried and convicted for these felonies in 2011. So he was awaiting sentencing. And this river guide, who was a river activist on the Colorado River, which is a beautiful, big river in the American West, had offered to take Tim through this place called Cataract Canyon, which is a very, very wild and very challenging section, one of the most challenging sections of whitewater in the country. And it goes on for a long ways. And I had gotten to know this river guide because he was also a river activist, and I'd been talking to him about energy and water issues in the West. And he knew about my loss of Carolyn, and he believes that the river has healing powers, that passing through it and is a healing experience. So he invited me to come along on this, and I thought, okay, I'll give that a try, and I'll go. I actually was, when I first heard about Cataract Canyon, I went and looked online at these. A friend sent me a link to some videos there, and if you Google Cataract Canyon, you will decide I am never going to this place ever, because the videos are really they're really bad. These boats running this, you know.
What just, boats these, do they run them in?
Well, they run them mostly in these rubberized
rafts,
you know, with stiff bottoms and oars. So you go down with oars, not with paddles. Big, long oars, and there's one boatman rowing. And the boats are, I think our boat was 17 feet long, and there were three of us in it. But it's really hairy. It's really hairy. But then I thought, okay, I'm going to go, and I'm not going to be afraid, and I'm just going to go.
Back before the break, Alex Chadwick had begun talking about a recently completed sound project called The Descent. This tells the story of how two men, Alex himself, a recent widower, and environmental activist Tim DeChristopher, who was awaiting prison sentencing, found their way through the Big Water Rapids of Utah's Cataract Canyon.
It's just wonderful. And then you hit Cataract Canyon, and oh my God, it's just really
Were
hairy.
You scared?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was terrified at one point, and that was, so you're through the Green River, and then before you run Cataract Canyon, the river guide, John Weisite, has to pull over to the side and say, well, you're going to camp out before you run Cataract Canyon anyway. You're going to sleep again. But he has to pull over and say, okay, now we're in the rapids, and now here are all the things that can go wrong, and if you fall out of the boat, this is what you do. And you kind of – that was really scary. The kind of the safety talk about, you know, what things are going to be like, that was really scary. That was the scariest part of the whole trip. But then actually when you get into the water, there were moments that were pretty scary. There were moments that were, yeah, it was.
But you're probably pretty, you're busy while this is going on.
Yeah, you're busy holding on and praying.
Yeah.
No, and just kind of watch. And then, so I had started doing interviews on this trip and taking notes. Now, I hadn't really worked in a year and a half, 2 years. I hadn't done anything. I mean, I just hadn't been able to. And even if you're good at something, if you don't do it for that long, you really wonder. And I was very angry with NPR, and I just didn't know if I wanted to do this or if I could still do it. And sort of in the course of that week, I thought, okay, there's something going on. There was another. There was a woman along on the trip who makes documentary films. She wasn't shooting anything at that time. She was just there because she liked to go on the river. And she came up to me after 3 or 4 days. She said, I noticed you're not really recording anything. At that point, I thought, oh, yeah, right. I'm supposed to be. I was recording. I was recording when they were. I would go down early in the morning and I'd record the river before anybody else was up, you know, because you want that ambient sound, because then you can write over that. You can write your story. So that's what I do. I write stories and I use ambient sound to give you a sense of place. And then I interview a person to try to get them to come out a little bit. But here, as I was writing this story, I didn't know how I was going to write it. And it was the hardest story I ever wrote. But I put me in this story, and I put Carolyn, my wife, in this story. And so
you put you as you were at that time,
yeah,
going through this,
yeah,
transition.
Me trying to figure out what to do. And Tim, I started the story by saying that this guy Tim, is about to go to prison. And he doesn't know how long his sentence is going to be. He was awaiting sentencing. And then I said, I'm already in a kind of a prison, and I don't know my sentence either. So, you know, here we go down this river. And if you're lost, maybe a river is a good thing to be on because it only goes one place. And that so from the beginning, the story was about both of our stories and the story of trying to run this river. And for Tim and really for me too, what you learn from this experience is that as dangerous as the river is, as difficult, that there's a line through there. And if you're calm and careful, you can see the line and find the way.
Just like life.
Just like life.
Did the actual putting together of the program do anything to your perspective on you and this river running? And
well, it kind of made me realize that I could still do this, and more than, I mean, when this story ran, it had a big impact. People really responded to it as a story, as an emotional experience, as a creative experience. As a kind of a thrill moment. So it worked. I could see that as a creative experience, it was strong. And it gave me confidence that I could follow my instincts, as I have pretty much always. And it just kind of, it gave me confidence and kind of restored me and announced to the community that I'm back and I'm writing again. And so it's been good. Okay, so on this river trip, it is a kind of this creative thing that happens in this piece. When you hit the rapids are represented by this tabla player, this Indian drum thing that's quite musical and beautiful and rhythmic. And so that's there because I had interviewed this tabla player years before, really liked him. He's in L.A., and his music had always spoken to me. So when we're running these rapids, I had two recorders with me, one really, really good one, and one backup that was okay, but it wasn't great. The really, really good one is a stereo, very, very good recorder, beautiful microphones and everything. It requires a special cable to link, you know, cable A to cable B to go into the thing. Of course, I didn't have that cable. I forgot that cable. So the only recorder I had was, you know, the backup recorder. And I didn't, I thought, I've got to get the sound of going through these rapids. Because when you hit these rapids, I mean, you'd go over these, like, little falls, these things, again and again and again. When the boat drops, you know, you drop 4 or 5 feet or more, and I'm sitting in the bow, and you're just soaked in water. It's just running all over you. So I just didn't dare have, because if I lost that recorder, I was dead. I knew that. So, Mr. Experienced Reporter, Mr. Know-It-All, forgot the cable. So I never had the sound of the, you know, here it is, this story about running through these various dangerous, active, you know, rapid, well, they're not there.
But there's a lot of sound of you standing by the river.
I'm standing by the river getting it, but believe me, that is not the same thing. And anyone who's been through the river must have been thinking, so, wait a minute, where the hell are the rapids? Rolls into an opening. Then we're sliding down in a strange blend of speed and slow motion. The water's fast, but in the boat, each moment stretches like a dream as though we're falling.
What are you doing now?
There's a public radio energy series called Burn and Energy Journal, and I am the host and senior correspondent for that. It's a series of public radio specials about energy, all kinds of nuclear, petroleum, alternatives. This is with a grant from the National Science Foundation. We're trying to explain very fundamental, necessary things for people to know about energy. Like, for instance, when you go find oil, it's not in reservoirs under the earth. It's not a pool of oil down there. You raised your eyebrows. It's not? Right. I thought it was too, but it's not. No. It's all in little porous rock. And you've got, so
All of it.
There are no pools of oil down there that we're kind of sticking the straw into and sucking it out, which is what I thought. But so we're trying to explain a lot of things about energy, about nuclear energy, about oil, about renewables. So we've done 2 one-hour specials, and we're working on 2 more for the fall.
You talked about doing your rapid adventure and the program, the show that came out of that, and that it sort of rekindled your confidence. How about your fire?
So the radio that I'm making now, the things that I'm doing now, they just suit me pretty well. I'm not filing for a daily show anymore. And I really, that helped me a lot when I was kind of getting onto this energy stuff, because I got to know people in the energy community in Utah, people in the industry who are very skeptical of reporters, and it's very, very hard to get these people to talk to you. But I wasn't talking to them because I needed a story from them because I need to file for tomorrow morning. I was talking to them because I needed background and I needed to understand and I needed to learn. And that's a much different circumstance from the way that I, as a reporter, would normally talk to people, which provokes anxiety on their part and on my part, right? Often when a reporter goes in to talk to somebody, it's a very anxious situation because both of them have something to lose and something to gain, and it's very immediate. It's hard to establish a trust relationship in that kind of encounter. The difference was I wasn't getting paid. You know, I wasn't making any money while I was doing this. I was just determined that I was going to learn about energy and I was going to do this kind of reporting. And I just somehow thought that, well, something will happen someday and this will work out. So the amazing thing is I was afraid of this river trip, you know, and then I thought, okay, I'm not going to be afraid. I'm going to go on it. I'm going to go pass through this testing almost. So at the end of that, people started calling me up and offering me money. And I was so dramatic. It was ridiculous. And I kind of wandered around for months, really, talking to people and friends and saying, would you please explain this to me? And I nobody could explain this. But anyway, I finally stopped bothering my friends with this and just thought, well, that's the way it
is.
Yeah, took the money.
Let's talk about you and photography.
Okay.
Specifically, how long you've been coming to Charlottesville.
Well, so my first trip to Charlottesville was to visit my brother at UVA, and neither one of us remembers anything of it. That was probably 1970. But probably about 15 years ago, or maybe a little bit longer, I came down here to the home of the photographer Nick Nichols, Look 3 founder, because his home had become the sort of launch site for this big Africa trip that his friend, the African explorer and biologist Mike Fay, was going to walk from the middle of Africa out to middle of the Congo out to the Atlantic coast. This was a huge story in National Geographic. Nick took masterful photographs, produced a huge book from it called The Last Place on Earth. It's one of the great photo books. My wife was working with National Geographic, and she, through her, I was working with National Geographic, and I just got to know a lot of Geographic people. But Nick has this kind of special quality, as I'm sure many people in Charlottesville or the surrounding area know. And he used to have these summer backyard photo things, and I went to one of those, and that sort of evolved into Look 3. And I just always had an interest in photography, and I like it, and I like photographers. They're interesting people. It just was an affinity. So Nick decides to put on these shows and really make them. And he had already at Geographic, he organized events at National Geographic. They have an annual Photographer's Day where all the Geographic photographers fly into Washington, and they have 2 or 3 days of seminars and then one day of kind of events and things. And they would ask me to interview one of their star photographers on stage, because I've done a lot of interviews, and because by now I was friends with these guys and they knew that I had an affinity and liked photography and was genuinely interested in what they were doing. So it was just an extension of that for Nick to invite me to come down here to Look 3. And the first year, I think I interviewed 2 or 3 photographers, 2 maybe. I don't remember. But soon after that, we realized we should get some other people to interview some of these photographers. So since then, I've done 1 or 2 a year. So this year, I'm going to interview 2 people. In a sense of where do writers and creative people go, a lot of them, oddly, are going to radio. So influenced by This American Life, I think, that kind of quality of storytelling. So there are 2 local programs at the local public radio station in Los Angeles that are just narrative storytelling programs. And I did The Descent that went on one of these programs. So I'm always looking for a story that I could tell there. And so as I'm circulating this week, I'm going to be looking for a photographer who's got, you know, a good defined kind of beginning, middle, end story about a trip that they took or a story that they're working on or something, you know, some anecdote that we can spin out into a story. It won't, you know, be 5 or 6 minutes or 7 minutes long. So I'm going to be listening carefully to people and just see what I can pick up from them.
How is life now?
It's an adjustment, you know, it's an adjustment, and it'll continue to be. I'm grateful that I can still work and that I feel intellectually challenged and also emotionally challenged by storytelling, that I'm interested in working again, and that I find these outlets, and I find that people respond to what I do. I learned a lot from the experience of losing Carolyn, and really I learned a lot about vulnerability, and what you gain isn't the right word. It's not what you gain from it. It's what you learn from it and how you maybe are better able to relate to people and better able to understand, better able to listen to people and empathize with people, which is I'm better at that now than I used to be. And it's from going through this experience of loss and seeing the incredible compassion of the people who cared for Carolyn and who care for so many others. So, you know, seeing that, learning from that has kind of made things different.
break with Ballerina on the Brink, Leah Heller.